6 CR State v. Dodson. Representing Mr. Dodson, Michael J. Bax.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Backus, and I represent the petitioner in this action, Richard Dodson. Your Honor, I believe the issues before this court, the issues that we petitioned this court, strike to the very heart of due process. They bring to question the very fundamentals that we strive to protect. They involve cases that are the most riveting and most compelling. And what we are asking the court to do is, as Professor Turkheimer has stated, to run a delicate balancing as to the concerns that this court must have when it comes to children and the accused. We ask the court to consider here, specifically with respect to the appellate court's finding, that we're here today, I think, primarily to look at the significantly similar criteria of Polizano as it applies to this case, and I would respectfully submit to others in the future. We have, for example, in this case, if we look at Dodson's case specifically, we had the first witness, Brian, where at the conclusion of the direct, the court felt a need to take a recess. Subsequent to that, there was a lengthy cross, redirect, recross, all in front of a jury. I asked the court to consider, in its balancing, how much more would it have taken with a jury not in the room, with a qualified trial judge to investigate as to whether what the defense is asking for has a basis to proceed. Because that's what we have here. We have an allegation. We have a statement being made that directly relates to what the defendant is being charged with. We have a young boy saying that he made me take off my clothes, and he took off his clothes, and then he got on top of me, and then he did something. And how is that different from in the interest of Michael R.B., where none of that was there? And instead we had an assault, and we were relating it to a touching, and evidence was being sought of a touching, which was not related and was properly excused. We ask in the court's balancing, and which is not popular, I suppose. I mean, certainly if I were here speaking for the rights of children, I would perhaps get many pats on the back and asked to give some statements for the newspaper. When you appear for the accused, what should the court consider in balancing? And I think it is not asking too much that it is appropriate for the court to consider what, let's take Mr. Dodson and those that who love him, and he does have family, is facing. 20 years plus 20 years, there will be no admission, therefore there will be nothing but an MR. Consecutive probation, 20 years, conditions of probation, counseling, conditions of counseling, admission, no counseling, revocation, 20 years. Sexual predator, no admission, a threat. We're talking a human life. How much, in comparison, are we asking the court to consider directing trial courts to do, but to take a moment, which would have been minuscule in comparison to what this child had already been through, without a trial, without a jury there, and allow the offer of proof to expand, which was denied in this case. Had that been done, we believe the appellate court would have found that the Polizano criteria applied to all three counts. We cannot, in my view, and I respectfully submit to court, somehow just forget the right. We talk about that right of the defense, the right to present a defense. It doesn't sound the same as protecting the rights of children, but we're asking the court in this decision to revisit Michael, in the interest of Michael R.B., to compare that with other case law and the Polizano criteria.
Mr. Bacchus, would you explain what you just said a couple of minutes ago about the request to expand the offer of proof? I understand that there was an offer of proof here. Now, would you explain what was meant by that?
Your Honor, in the offer of proof, there was reference to, as Court of Appeals cites, a sexual assault. However,
sexual assault, penis to anus, right? We're talking about. And that's why. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
That's what was alleged. What was not, what was requested, and what I believe what was being sought by trial counsel, if you look to what was being stated, was that, Your Honor, we have the mother here that's going to say this. We have Bobby Moore here, an adult, who has is in prison now for this similar type of assault. He is in there for assaulting the children in a similar manner. And what we want to find out is, okay, was there similarity here in the touching parts? And in the offer itself, it didn't get into that in detail. But what I'm asking the court to do is to look and say to a trial court, look at what you have here. Look at what's being stated. I mean, are we to expect, for example, the Mrs. Dotson, who was in her 60s, I believe, at that time, when she receives a statement that says, you know, that Bobby did this to me, that she's supposed to think, well, was there some touching before he did this to me? Is a trial counsel supposed to be in a position of saying, well, now you better say this too? Because if we don't say these little words, then we don't have a proper offer of proof.
Counsel, let me just change this scene. Let us suppose that there was no charge of anal intercourse. Okay? Let us just suppose anal assault. There's no that charge. The only charge we have are charges of sexual contact. Okay? That's the what the trial's all about. Now, on the trial for those counts only, do you think that evidence of other acts by another person is relevant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. To what issue? What are you trying to prove?
It's knowledge, ability.
Why is knowledge important?
Your Honor, because although matters are changing rapidly, what we have still before us today is a society that cannot, and juries, and in the case of this case in particular, an aggressive prosecutor who is driving home these points and saying, how else can this child know these things? How can it describe this touching, this rubbing, this manner, that manner? How can this child do that, ladies and gentlemen, unless it knew something more that's not available to children of this age?
But here, the jury also heard the charge of the harmful materials, which, as I understand, were, for a better word, nude movies or whatever. And the jury, at least as I understand it, was sophisticated enough to find your client not guilty of that particular charge. But actually, the descriptive part of that, as I read in the record, was there for the child did actually view those tapes and certainly could have obtained knowledge from just that alleged harmful material.
Your Honor, as I recall, that tape, or what was described in the record regarding it, involved intercourse between adults. I don't know, quite frankly, everything that was on that tape, but I think it's dangerous to assume that the acts that the child described were on the tape.
No, I was just indicating to you that there was some sophistication that the jury had as far as that particular charge.
I believe the jury did deliberate and was, to use Your Honor's term, sophisticated enough to do that.
Yes. Let me ask, did the prosecutor in closing arguments argue to the jury that the only way this child would have been able to describe the sexual touching was if it had occurred?
The argument was that, not specifically using that language, Your Honor, but the argument was that we have, and again, an aggressive prosecution, as we see here, there was two problems. One was he referred to the physical evidence supporting, and that, of course, relates to the reversal that the appellate court made. But beyond
that... Let me stop you, since you're on that point, and I've not read the closing argument. Was there an argument that the physical evidence... I assume there was an argument that the physical evidence corroborates the victim's testimony vis-a-vis the sexual intercourse.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was there an argument that the physical evidence corroborates the victim's version of these assaults?
No.
Okay.
Were the final arguments recorded?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But beyond that, there was, again, which concerns me, and I think what the court we're asking the court to consider as a part of its consideration, is that we have this aggressive nature here that is also, I think, misquoting the law with respect to witty evidence and pushing again wherever possible to indicate that, certainly that the child victim had to be assaulted for this allegation to come forward.
Let me ask you to change the facts a little bit, and when I ask your position on it, I'm going to also ask the state. Let's assume, for whatever reason in this case, the state had decided only to charge the contact counts and had decided not to charge the sexual intercourse. But they brought in a witty evidence motion asking the trial court to admit the allegation of sexual intercourse as other acts evidence to prove up the sexual contact. That scenario could happen, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And assuming, for purposes of our discussion, that the court finds that they were close in time, that they were related, they show a pattern, all the kinds of things that may make it admissible under 90404, and the trial court says, okay, we're going to let that in for purposes of proving up the sexual contact. Is it your position that the prior sexual contact vis-a-vis the anal tag issue would have been admissible to impeach the witty evidence in order to decide credibility on the underlying accounts?
I would say that at this moment, I would say yes. I mean, it just strikes me as it should be, although I would admit I haven't thought too far.
The reason I ask that question is that permeation of analysis is different than what you argued in your briefs. I mean, you're arguing that the prior sexual assault on this child is closely related and therefore admissible on the context. But it seems to me in part, part of your argument might be that if it is admissible to impeach the child's version of the sexual intercourse, that ought to be admissible on the issue of credibility and believability of the sexual contact.
I guess, Your Honor, I find myself viewing that like if the state brings the motion, it's opening the door to this. Had the state not brought it, we probably...
The witty evidence motion, man.
Yes,
yeah.
It's being forced on the defense at that point.
So your position is that it would be admissible?
Yes,
okay.
To counter what's being presented.
But you answered me that it would be admissible for knowledge.
We're asking that be found, yes, pursuant to...
In the question I asked with just the sexual contact case.
That's a separate argument. You're arguing that the child's description of having the sexual contact in this in this incident ought to be able to be impeached by the fact that the child has had prior sexual contact, and therefore to explain why the child might be able to in detail describe sexual contact when it might not have occurred in this case. I mean, that's your theory.
Yes, and the key, of course, is preventing, and what this court, and I want this court to please understand, is that I'm not looking to ask it to enter onto a slippery slope whereas the second-rate concerns of this court are eviscerated. I'm asking the court to trust the trial court to be able to control this situation, but to direct the trial court that when there is a basis, not just as you had in R.B., Michael R.B., an unrelated matter of a touching as it relates to an assault, but just the opposite here, and where the facts are that are in the offer to proof set a basis to think that something might have happened here, to give greater leeway in the balancing again, to allow the defendant to pursue it without a jury there in a controlled manner with the court, far less damaging to the child than what the child has, in this case, sadly already been through. We're not asking that much more. And yet, we're asking the court to consider what this means to those who are accused. I think that is the fundamental issue with respect to Polizano and Michael R.B. that I wish to present to the court. In addition, I am concerned, and I think this case equally directs a fundamental issue with respect to the Jensen issue that we have presented, which is obviously the jury instruction issue. And it seems to me that what the appellate court is saying and what the state is acknowledging is that there's a mistake that's been made. I mean, mistake's been made. And I quite frankly cannot understand how it's not a complete contradiction to Jensen that, in fact, the jury was improperly presented the law. And not only that, pursuant to the Fisher-Geiser requirements, it also is in conflict. We have it within the instruction itself, a conflict. And when we again look at the ramifications of this and what's at stake, we believe, Your Honors, that the proper course would be to, as the jury instruction already states, is to say that this must be presumed to create a problem. We have evidence, not only witty evidence, we have evidence of multiple acts being charged in a fewer number of counts. There's allegations of 5 to 10 acts, even in Kenosha, and 3 counts being charged. Then there's, of course, the other allegations coming forward. And then we go to a jury and say, well, already you have February through August here as a time frame, but you don't have to find that the acts occurred in that time frame.
Mr. Bacchus, isn't there a major distinction between what occurred in this case, allegedly, and the Jensen case? The Jensen case, as I understand it, involved an alibi defense. There wasn't any alibi defense here, was there?
There was an effort, as best counsel could, and I think that is of concern, Your Honor, to present an alibi, and that's our problem here, is that, you know, as I read the transcripts, it appears that counsel was able to fight this down to a month of May of that year, 1992. This from the original matter of complaint, which went February through January, 93, and then modified the information from February to August. So you try to formulate an alibi for all these times, and there's no specific alibi here because it's not so-and-so did this to me, this singular thing on February 20, 1998. It didn't happen that way. And so when a jury is receiving this instruction, it's saying, okay, well, it tells us we don't have to even consider this time frame. We're allowed to go beyond this. But then it says we should be, later in the instruction, immediately afterward, contradicts it. And I think if we're concerned about unanimous verdicts, as I'm sure we all are, that you have to wonder what kind of danger rests here. And I, quite frankly, cannot understand the appellate court's ignoring this fact. I mean, it seems so fundamental to me that in arguing it, I just state here it is. And something's wrong. It's complex.
Do you think that the instruction 255 should not have been given in any case, or is it really the insertion of the word between that causes the problem?
Both, Your Honor. We submit that it shouldn't have been given to begin with, and I think the instruction to me is clear that it shouldn't have been given, and defense counsel made a great record, I think, in saying this shouldn't be given. We're asking for trouble here. Under the pressure of the moment, he really dug in his heels on this issue and fought it. But the prosecution, again, pushed, and the judge went along with it. And it's clearly erroneous. It's clearly wrong. It should never have been given. But then you change the language, and it compounds it dramatically. And to say, well, we do have a separation of time here, sort of. I mean, it's not... There is, in viewing the Jensen language, there is, one can argue that... Well, it talks about being close in time, and here we don't have close in time. We're talking about a broad range, but to me, it's still the purposes of that restriction were not met. And we're at... Yes, sir.
No, I just wanted, because I clearly understood, and I did not read the entire record, but that there was no alibi used by your client in this case. And you're saying, well, he tried to have one, and it's clear in the record that he did attempt to put in an alibi.
There was discussion of alibi, Your Honor. In fact, there was some complaints by the state that it wanted some time out to prepare for some witnesses because they were unnamed alibi witnesses. But it's not a real alibi. I mean, there was no way to come up with an alibi. The time frame was too broad. We just cannot account, nor can any person, for such a broad period of time. And so the aspect of alibi falls by the wayside a bit, I must admit. But there was a term used, and I believe what counsel was trying to do as best he could, given his time frame, to, in fact, try to narrow this thing down right at trial. And the issue was there, in my view, although I would certainly acknowledge, as it's discussed in Jensen, it does not apply.
Counsel, getting back for a moment to the first issue. At trial, I've not read the trial transcript. Was there any effort made to show a motive on the part of the victim here to testify falsely?
There was an effort to try to explain. I'm not sure I can go with the term motive, but it sort of is a motive that there was family problems. There was a divorce action, and that there may have been some pressures on him, that in fact the defense that counsel wanted to pursue he couldn't, which of course was that there was influence of Bobby Moore to basically put this on to the defendant. But there was some effort in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, ma'am. Please, the court. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm Assistant Attorney General here on behalf of the state. To me, what this boils down to is that if we consider only the contact cases, Mr. Dodson got exactly the trial to which he was entitled. Nothing came in that case that shouldn't have come in. The evidence that, in my view, that he complains of not coming in this case was not admissible.
We try not to interrupt for 5 minutes. Since you're on it, I would like you to. I'd like you to take. Maybe we'll go through this together. In my proposed scenario, where the state does not charge the sexual intercourse, but attempts to use it as witty evidence, and I think that they. I mean, that's not an unlikely scenario. Would you agree that the trial court most likely would have admitted it, assuming we have the facts here?
I don't know if I would say most likely would have admitted it. I certainly could envision a trial court.
It could be permissibly admissible under the rules.
I think it's a close call, but I could certainly see a trial court agreeing that because of the closeness of the allegation for the anal assault and the context,
fact,
that it could have been a...
In fact, that's one of the things we look at in terms of joinder issues on these kinds of counts, is whether the evidence of one count might be admissible on the other under
90404. Right. And I think, see, that's... I think that makes it a two-edged sword, because if, in fact, it's admissible under 904, then what's the harm of... If it's admissible under 904, then it either comes in or doesn't. I mean, either way you go, then his trial is accurate. I mean, requirement of the state to bring it in.
Let's assume, just except for my... I think that many trial judges, if they were given the scenario of the admissibility of the sexual intercourse in a trial on a sexual contract to show plan and motive under sexual behavior, it would probably be admissible, and if they made a decent record, it would be upheld on appeal. So let's assume we have that scenario. Because the jury did, in fact, hear about the sexual intercourse in the trial on the sexual contract because it was the same trial. What is your position, then, on the admissibility of the prior sexual intercourse by the defense to impeach the witty evidence?
It wasn't prior sexual intercourse by the defendant. By the other person, actually by a witness.
Well, it's the defendant trying to get it in.
The defendant trying to move in the evidence of
the prior sexual assault to impeach, in my scenario, the witty evidence.
Right. And I think the dynamics of the admissibility of that evidence when it comes in a witty situation is different than if it comes in the prosecution itself, because we're talking about, we're examining under 90403,
right,
and it's something that is remote in the sense that it doesn't directly attack any of the evidence going to the crime itself. It attacks this other acts evidence, and it's a question of whether or not the act that's complained of as an other act becomes admissible to begin with. And if you go back before the advent of the federal rule and the state rule that allows this other act's evidence in, this is the exact theory about why that kind of evidence shouldn't come in to begin with. It's because it diverts the jury from the real issue.
Okay, let's assume, and the trial judge would have a lot of discretion on that under 904.3, but let's not look at that. In terms of whether or not it's probative and relevant in attacking the prior witty evidence, does it meet that test?
I'm not convinced that it is all that probative.
So you disagree with the Court of Appeals opinion that it should have been admitted in this case?
Well, I probably do. We didn't petition on that because in the actual assault case, it's easy to, although it didn't happen like this, it's easy to envision it becoming more probative and admissible because the victim gets asked, did it happen or not? And if he says no, then it becomes a prior inconsistent statement. Now, that never happened, so...
Well, see, the problem I have is that, you know, we're looking at this case, we're really shining the light at this appeal on the two sexual contact counts. I mean, that's what we're looking at. What's admissible, what isn't admissible, and what occurred at the trial court level when the defendant was convicted of those two counts. And what we know happened at the trial court level is the jury not only heard about those sexual contacts, but did hear, for purposes of our analysis now, the other act, the sexual intercourse, the conviction that's been set aside. And they heard that, so they heard that according to the victim, the defendant not only sexually touched, but sexually assaulted via intercourse. And the Court of Appeals has said they heard that, but they didn't hear the impeachment part of that, and so we're going to reverse that part of the conviction. But we're not going to reverse the contact, even though the jury could have and probably did use the victim's version vis-a-vis the intercourse to obtain the conviction on the contact. That's where my concern is that either the jury should have heard it all or didn't hear it all, and to say that two of those convictions are okay but one isn't, and they're going to if the jury hears, and the second time around, the other contact, and finds the defendant not guilty, what they're going to be doing is saying they can't believe the victim beyond a reasonable doubt. And yet, another jury has found the victim credible beyond a reasonable doubt when they didn't have the benefit of that evidence. So that's where I'm torn, and I guess I'd like you to address that.
Well, I guess my response to that is, if these had been tried separately, and setting aside that, I believe that if the trial court would have said, yes, I'm going to allow this as witty evidence, but no, I'm going to bar this Mrs. Dodson's statement is too remote because it goes to witty evidence and not to the criminal conviction, would that be upheld on appeal? I think the answer to that is yes, it would. And that is what the situation we have here.
Maybe the jury would not have been able to hear about the physical parts of the sexual intercourse. See, a jury is listening, and it's a he-said-he-said kind of case, except there's physical evidence to corroborate the sexual intercourse.
Well, certainly the state argued it did, but...
And you don't think a jury...
There's no evidence.
I mean, you know that a jury is looking for anything to corroborate one side or another. You've got victim saying one thing, and if it's all he-said-he-said or he-said-she-said... You got to decide on credibility. But once there's some corroborative evidence, whether it be physical injuries or other kinds of evidence, that's certainly important to a jury. And here we have the corroborative evidence, but not the impeaching evidence on the corroborative evidence.
Right. That's true. First, my first answer is still, could that have happened in a trial on only the sexual assaults? And I think the answer to that is yes, and it would have been upheld on appeal. The second is... I don't think the fact that this kid had prior sexual assault and that it had an anal tag tended to prove that he wasn't assaulted on this particular occasion. And that's especially true vis-a-vis the touching case.
Let me come at this from a different standpoint, but still on the same avenue. I didn't say as a preliminary statement that my concern here is that the eggs are so scrambled you can never unscramble them. Because I take as a basic assumption that the Court of Appeals was correct in saying that this evidence should have come in as to the first count.
As to the anal intercourse.
As to the ADS. Which means then that there was either an improper joinder it goes back. I mean, if you could start it all over again and understand that this evidence has to come in as to the first count, then you should. Then the state would have never tried them together, theoretically, because you're going to have, at least with the sexual contact evidence, you might not get the evidence of the other victim might not have to come in. So if you separated them out and had one trial on the anal intercourse and the other on the contact, you'd have very different evidence coming in on both. But the problem here is you didn't. The problem here is that with respect to the contact cases, you had evidence of the anal intercourse, and the evidence of the anal intercourse was rebutted by, or at least potentially rebutted by, this other witness. So how can there not be spillover? How can the Court of Appeals say, in a trial that concerns all three charges, that the jury shouldn't hear of this evidence with respect to all three?
The answer to that, I think, is would a trial that admitted the anal intercourse evidence as witty evidence and barred the Dolores Dodson statement, would that be upheld on appeal? And because whether or not that Dolores Dodson statement comes in when the anal intercourse is witty evidence is a discretionary decision, and it is substantially remote, and it has a great tendency to divert the jury away from the trial of what they're really supposed to decide, which is whether or not the contact occurred in this case. I think a judge deciding that, no, that's too remote and I'm not going to allow that impeachment evidence in, even though the Witte evidence is, which I view the Witte evidence as a close call, so even it's even more remote.
Here's the problem I have with that, and you may be right, but none of that happened. The trial judge never made that kind of assessment that impeachment of the Witte evidence, because none of it occurred that way. We never had the judge saying, okay, you know, the jury's going to hear about the anal intercourse vis-a-vis the contact because it tends to show plan. They didn't have to do it because it was joined. But we never had a trial judge saying, I'm not going to allow this impeachment because it's a waste of time, even though it may have some probative value to impeach that Witte evidence. It's outweighed by the unfair prejudice and you know, on and on. None of that weighing or analysis occurred, so it's hard for us to even know what the trial judge would have done had he decided that, in fact, you ought to exclude it on that basis. I mean, he just never got to that point.
That's true. He excluded it on the basis of the rape shield. And, of course, whether it comes in to rebut the Witte evidence, the rape shield has to be factored into that, too.
Now, even if the trial judge did not carefully analyze all of this, the trial judge did exercise its discretion here. And we can review it through review the record and decide that the discretion was or was not exercised properly on the basis of this record. We don't have to just say...
What exercise of discretion did he do, though? What was the analysis?
Here?
Yeah.
Here the analysis was whether or not the evidence was barred by the rape shield statute.
Which is a different analysis than admissibility and relevancy, right?
Well,
I think in the first instance there was a determination sub silentio that it was relevant because otherwise it could have been barred on that ground.
Well, now under the rape shield statute, case law, one, did the prior acts clearly occur?
Yes, and if you believe Ms. Dotson, that was met.
Two, the acts closely resemble those of the present case. Three, and this is a Witte, as I see it, that the prior act is clearly relevant to a material issue. That's a Witte test.
Same test. Same time, yeah.
That the evidence is necessary to the defendant's case. Same test as in Witte. Usually Witte, the state is putting it in, so you have to ask, is it relevant to the state's case? That the probative value of the evidence outweighs its prejudicial effect.
That's 904-3,
which is standard in a Witte case, too. That's the last
prong. That's the second prong.
So the trial judge here had to decide, if the court was following this, that the prior acts were clearly relevant to a material issue.
Well, of course, if it's Witte evidence, it's the wrong party offering it, but...
No, Witte evidence can be brought by either the state or the defendant, and so... It's just more often that we see it with the state.
Well, yes, I agree with that. On the other hand, it's hard to imagine a defendant wanting to put this type of Witte evidence in.
But we have it here. The defendant here is asking to put in other acts evidence. Not against him, but other acts evidence.
Other acts of the witness.
Okay. Of a witness. So we have to know, that's why I keep pressing the defendant, is it relevant to a material issue? That's the first step of it. So I keep saying, what's the issue? And the issue is knowledge, apparently.
Well, if we're talking only the contact cases, then I think that's right. And our view is, that's not enough in a contact case. And it's not enough in this particular case, I think, for at least two reasons. One is, you don't need to show other sexual knowledge for touching. The two is that the record does disclose that there was an alternative source of sexual knowledge in the case. And to use the defendant's own argument, if the films portrayed sexual intercourse, they must have portrayed touching. And thirdly, it seems to me that when you look at the witness's testimony in this case, there's nothing in the nature of the testimony that indicates such a precocious knowledge that one would think, oh, gee, he couldn't describe it like that unless it happened. I mean, he just said, the defendant rubbed my penis on his chest. I mean, it's just a normal description. I mean, so in the cases where you look at the cases primarily going admitting this kind of evidence for sexual knowledge, it's usually younger kids, but even setting that aside, there's something about the testimony that the red flag goes up and says, hey, a kid that age is not going to be able to describe it in those terms. But that's not here. That's not in this record. So for those three reasons, it seems to me that as to knowledge, this particular offer wouldn't survive or shouldn't survive.
You know, this case is going back for retrial, theoretically.
Well, at least the one count is, yeah.
Okay. And in light of the comments that Justice Geske made in terms of, in effect, at the original trial, the jury heard about the anal intercourse but didn't hear the impeachment of that. Doesn't it make better sense to retry the whole thing?
Well, I don't know that that's a good idea for a couple of reasons. One is the state may decide not to retry if the two convictions stand, not to retry the third one, because they don't want to put the victim through it. And that's perhaps not a bad decision if those two are affirmed. That's not a bad decision in a public policy sense. Second of all, if the defendant got everything he was entitled to, it seems to me that that's not a good policy decision from a judicial resources point of view to retry the case knowing that it's basically the same evidence and the same is going to come in the same way. And we can presume, although we don't know, the same juries are going to react the same, likely the same result.
In light of what we know now, should the defendant have severed here?
Well, in light of what we know now, maybe the state wouldn't have brought them together. I mean, I think that's one of the strategic kinds of decisions the state would have to make had it known that Politano was going to require the Mrs. Dotson evidence to come in. It may have decided, wait a minute, I don't want to try these contact cases with that.
Would the defense have had any realistic chance of success on a motion to sever these counts, in your experience?
Well, if everyone was aware of Mrs. Dotson's evidence at the time, that may have affected a severance motion.
Well, the state may have wanted it then.
I'm sorry?
The state may have wanted a severance motion then.
Right. And the court, even if the state opposed it, the court might have said, well, if this is coming in, I'm sure I want that in with the contact case, so I'm going to sever it.
Well,
so,
but doesn't that just prove the point that we've got problems when they were tried together then? I mean,
anytime you join counts, you've got some of that problem. And for purposes of severance, we say, well, some problem is not enough. In terms of the instructions, it is true that the first sentence and the second sentence of the instruction seem to contradict each other. On the other hand, I went back and reread the transcript on how that instruction came to be, and it is, I guess to put it as graciously as possible, it's confusing. There were apparently the state offered one modification, the defendant apparently offered another modification, and out of that, the instruction that was given came. And my guess is, and it is just a guess, is that the first sentence was what the state wanted and the second sentence was what the defendant wanted. And they both were relatively accurate statements of the law. I mean, it's clear, in my view, that first statement that says the state doesn't have to prove the exact date of the offense is an accurate statement of the law. And the judge, before he finally decided what instruction, he went through that in some detail. So that's accurate. There could certainly be a problem with giving that instruction in this case. Of course, that's a discretionary decision. But it seems to me, when you really look at it, the witnesses in this case didn't testify about the date at all, none of them. And the state really put dates on it because some of the prior litigation at the beginning forced it, because the defendant wanted a more certain statement to which he was entitled, probably. And the state was concerned that if the jury believed that this actually happened 2 or 3 days before or 2 or 3 days after the date stated in the instruction, in the indictment, or I'm sorry, the information, that they would acquit, which of course the law is that if that happens, they're entitled to convict. In the end, there's no question that this kind of nebulous period, or the edges of this period being nebulous, the period was kind of tied to a particular area. The defendant was allowed to put in evidence that he worked, what days he worked within that period, and I mean, there was a lot of discussion about whether it's an alibi or not, and I think it is fair to say that it was not a true alibi. I viewed it as more of a lack of opportunity defense, because I think...
You could see it's pretty tough to come up with an alibi when you're
right,
using that time frame.
Yeah, when you're talking about a four-month period. And actually, I mean, we have other cases where even when the date and time of the offense is fairly definite, where somebody doesn't present what we would call an alibi, but wants to show lack of opportunity. So that's what happened here, and the defendant was, I mean, he didn't deny that the kid had never stayed at his house. So he was tying this when he worked to some prior testimony that said the assaults didn't happen on a day that he worked, and that's the way that all came in. But in essence, he knew the period. He was allowed to present evidence on the period. And I don't think there was any question that the jury, if it found that it happened, found that it happened within that general period. The other thing is the Jensen problem, and because of the different conduct, the problem in Jensen is a confusion between charged offenses and uncharged offenses that were the same, and that the jury would convict because he was charged with 3 counts, he did it 3 times, even though it wasn't the 3 that were charged. Well, that just wasn't present under the facts of this case. So I think the Court of Appeals was right in that regard. If the court is going to reverse this on the instruction, it seems to me, what you've got to do is reverse it on the fact that it's internally inconsistent, and it's not so confusing, I think, that it would mislead the jury about what they were supposed to find and determine whether or not they believe Mr. Dotson or they believe the victim. So in my view, it was not a sufficient error to justify a reversal.
But the 2 sentences in short read, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the state doesn't have to prove that the offenses were committed between the times charged, and the state does have to prove that the offenses.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. There's no way around that.
Interesting. Deliberations.
Yeah. But, I mean, if that really confused the jury, I think the most likely thing would be that they would just ignore it and go on.
But there was no evidence of any acts other than the ones charged?
There was evidence of acts. Well, there was a lot of evidence of a lot of acts in this case. But Mr. Dotson's acts against the defendant, against the victim, occurred in Illinois. And the judge gave a specific instruction that the jury could not convict on any act that occurred in Illinois. There was testimony that there was other acts with other young men. There was witty evidence to that, but that
the defendant had engaged in behavior with other men.
Yes, with some of the victim's friends, one of which was this Bobby Moore, who was alleged to have committed the act on the victim.
What was the other evidence put in for?
I think under the old rubric of common motive, which is the one you most see in witty. Similar conduct with other kids, showing either motive or intent. Sexual gratification is an element of the contact, so that was offered to show that he was doing it for sexual gratification. I guess the one thing that I would like to press on the court is, if this kind of a situation where the joinder cases are joined and there's Pulitzano-ish evidence that comes in that's not correctly barred, requires reversal of all kinds, all of the joined offenses. What we have to remember that what we're doing here is also saying that in rape cases, if there's a substantial battery attached, that's going to have to be reversed too.
I understand your concern, counsel. Where my concern is where a count one here, was very likely, or at least could easily have been used by the jury as a basis for the substantiation of counts two and three, given the closeness of the three charges. They're all sexual offenses. If, in fact, your building block, the base, is tainted, my concern is, doesn't the whole house fall?
Well, again, it seems to me that depends on whether or not that the same evidence going to the jury in the same way could have done that in the remaining count, the affirmed count, without error. And if that's the case, then it seems to me he's gotten everything he's entitled to.
And you could even argue harmless error.
Yeah, and of course we didn't in this case because the error that's found was in the Court of Appeal was only the Pulitzano one.
Right.
And it couldn't harm it, that one wasn't harmless.
No, but it's harmless error here.
Oh, right.
For the lack of this
Dodson evidence.
Dodson evidence.
This is Dodson's statement.
Right.
Yes.
Which would mitigate the sexual intercourse. So it was, if you take the position
that case came up alone,
Babbage and Garsky, take it right, that error there, if you accept that, it still might be harmless. I mean, that would be the statement.
Right. I would suspect that if that case came up alone, as I described it, we probably would argue that even if it was there, it should have come in and didn't, it was harmless, because it wouldn't have really affected the jury.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Backus.
Your Honor, I would ask the court to me it would be most difficult to find a basis upon which to ask cases like this to be severed. I mean, if there's any case that you don't want to sever, if you're looking at protecting the rights of a child or anyone else in such a vulnerable spot would be this case. What is needed, though, what I think we're asking for is a broader brush on the second criteria and directing trial courts to use their discretion, again, balancing this under these considerations I've mentioned, and that will provide the protection. And it can provide the basis. I just really have a hard time thinking we're going to have trial courts saying we're going to sever in order to accomplish a goal here with a child victim, as I see it. It's been stated that the defendant got what he is entitled to, and we're arguing that he did not. In this, again, with respect to the second criteria, I think the second criteria in this case, the defendant did not get what he's entitled to, which is the finding that it is similar and that there should be a broader view in such situations of looking at that criteria from a defendant's perspective is to ensure a fair hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Backus. The court's in recess until 1:45.